It's Saturday, January 21st, 2006, and you're listening to the Typical PC User Podcast. Well, good evening, everyone. It is Victor Cajiao of the Typical PC User Podcast, and I'm very happy to have you on board. You'll notice the mellow music. Well, the mellow music is to kind of mellow me out after what has been an incredibly frustrating week. No, I'm okay. As probably most of you know, I had some major problems with my feed earlier this week, and thank goodness we got them straightened out. And thanks to my Friends in Tech. Of course, this show is part of the Friends in Tech group, and Craig really stepped up and did a wonderful job in taking care of my issue. I'm going to leave the explanation of what happened to Craig and Chuck, who talked about it in their Chuck Chat Technorama show on Sunday. But suffice it to say that, it really bothered me because I'm pretty tech savvy when it comes to PCs or whatever, but I'm not a developer. And I did everything that I knew how to do in order to make sure that my feed was good, that it was validating, that all the things that I know to do to get the podcast out were being done. And it wasn't enough. The feed validated perfectly fine. Feed burner looked at it and it was cool, but it was still broken and you guys couldn't get to me. And I saw my listenership numbers and feed burner go from, I don't know, the mid 600s to 340. It was really depressing because, you put a lot of work out to make sure that this show serves you guys and that you guys subscribe, and all of a sudden you're gone. And whether you come back or not, I don't know. I don't know if I'll be able to recover from that part of it. Anyways, let's move on to a great show that I have for you tonight. We are going to start with Craig and Chuck talking about what happened to my server. Then I'm going to take you to Professor David Malin from Harvard University. That's right, he's back. I asked him to contribute to the show and he said he'd be happy to. And tonight's going to be one of several segments that Professor Malin is going to do. Tonight is going to be on home networking, and I think you're going to find that very, very interesting. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about rootkits and give you a little bit of an editorial on that specific subject. So, as you listen to tonight's show and the mellow music, I want you to remember that I really appreciate you subscribing to the show and being a part of the show. I need you to send me MP3s and listener mail and all those other things that make the podcast alive and make it yours. I'm a typical PC user at gmail.com, and I'd love to get your feedback. So let's get going with a great show for tonight. I hope you enjoy it. And I want to thank everyone of my listeners who provided me feedback when my feed was down, telling me what they were experiencing. All right, Craig, Chuck, take it away. Let's tell the folks what happened. Give them the technical explanation.
That, buddy.
All right. Now you're famous, or you're going to be famous.
I wonder if I'll be in the changelog. I doubt it. But anyway, I want to say about this. I want to be in the changelog for iTunes. Anyway, this last week, Victor Cajiao over at Typical PC User Podcast, he had some big funkiness going on with his show. He posted a show on, I think it was Saturday, is when he normally posts his shows. And when he posted it, he realized that something was wrong with his feed because in iTunes was acting funny.
You get the little exclamation point thing.
Yeah, what would happen is you would subscribe to the show or be subscribed. As soon as you did an update, it would download that show. If you did another update, it'd give you an exclamation point.
Yep.
What was happening was in his feed, he had an open tag, which not the RSS elements, but part of the HTML show notes. And there was an open tag in there. Well, iTunes got confused and actually would replace the subscribed URL that you're subscribed to, like a feed burner, a URL or something like that.
Yeah.
It would replace that with the last MP3 URL that you downloaded.
That's no good.
So when it when you try, so you would download that show, and if you tried to do an update, it would try to get XML information from that last URL you downloaded, which is an MP3, which is not going to work. So, so in effect, I think he's lost a lot of subscribers because they're not subscribed anymore, in effect. And iTunes does have functionality for you to put a little tag in your feed to tell it to subscribe to this new feed. You know, it's called...
Like forwarding. But,
yes, it's sort of like that. It'll actually change your subscription URL. However, that is not in there at all. Explicitly, it's not in there. So I don't know why they would just... iTunes would go, okay, I'll change it, you know, for no reason. So anyway, I worked on this for several... a couple of days. Because I knew he needed help.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a long weekend, so I really hammered on it. And I was close, but his buddy... Blaine McDonald actually found that one of the HTML tags was open, and that's what was confusing. As soon as I changed that, everything worked. But I mean, I upgraded his WordPress, I upgraded all the plugins, reposted different things, trying to figure it out. And every time I post one, you'd subscribe to it, it'd download it, and then change the URL. Every time.
We've got a public service announcement. If you listen to the Typical PC User podcast, we would like you to unsubscribe and resubscribe. And yes, that should clear up all the problems. The Typical Mac User podcast, his other show, seems to be fine at this point.
Now, just clicking the, you know how you can just click unsubscribe and then click subscribe? I don't think that's going to work. You have to unsubscribe.
You have to delete it from your list.
You have to remove it and then go back into the podcast directory or go to his website and click on the button. But yes, that's a big problem. And to Apple's credit, they actually got back to us pretty quickly. I mean, Victor was pretty, you know, surprised at that. And the guy said it's rare, and he has seen it once before, but he didn't have any data to go with to the developers and say, here, can you fix it? Which I did, because I made a static RSS XML file while I was posting and reposting, so I could only test it, and everything would stay the same. And so I still had a copy of that XML file.
That's awesome. You know, you see it from a developer's perspective.
Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to keep doing the unsubscribe, and people that have iPod or Juice Receiver or whatever, I didn't want them to keep downloading it. So I made a static file, and I just happened to rename it, you know, and set it aside when I was done with it. So hopefully that will help them out.
You da man. Three words.
That's right, Chuck. He beat a man, and he did a great job of helping me out. Thank you, Craig. I definitely owe you big time. All right, you guys, let's change the mood up a little bit and have Professor David Mainland, who, of course, is the professor of the Harvard University course that is taught on computing, and that podcast was very popular late in the year last year, starting with September. David Mainland decided to come back on the show and do some segments for me. Tonight, we're going to do the first of those segments on home networking. I think you're going to enjoy it. Please give me feedback at typicalpcuser@gmail.com.
Hello, my name is David Malin. I'm the instructor for Computer Science E1 at Harvard University's Extension School. Victor's asked me to chat with you today about home networking and what it takes to share an internet connection among several computers you might have here in your home or apartment, and what kind of security implications you should consider when doing so. So it wasn't too long ago that the cable modem providers and DSL modem providers of the world didn't really want people sharing their internet connection, because they would have preferred that people pay for two cable modems or two DSL modems, for instance, or at least two IP addresses, as they're called, so that they could use more than just one computer on their home network. Well, before long, they think the industry realized that this wasn't a feature they could really impede, particularly because you could set up rather easily a system in your home that allowed you to share your connection not only between two computers, but among an arbitrary number of computers. And that's where we are today. It is as simple as plugging in a device, for the most part, into your cable modem and then connecting one or more computers to that particular device in order to share your connection among as many computers as you want in your home, whether by wires or even these days wirelessly. And it's that device that's the focus of today's chat. So that device is typically called a router or an access point or a proxy server or firewall or a whole number of other terms, all of which are applicable because those little boxes, most commonly called probably home routers, are quite powerful little devices. These things only cost, you know, $20, maybe $40 these days, and you can even quite literally get them for free via certain promotions, via rebates if you keep your eye out. But the short of it is that they're quite inexpensive, and what they allow you to do, again, is to share your internet connection, whether that's DSL or cable modem, among as many computers really as you'd like within your home. Sharing a dial-up connection can't really be done so easily with these home routers, but you can do those via another means. But for now, we'll focus on cable modems and DSL modems, since that's probably what you do have in your home. So how does this work? Well, first of all, when you sign up for cable modem service or DSL modem service, not only does that provider provide you with a cable modem or a DSL modem, which essentially is a device that translates the data that you want to send and receive into signals that can be carried along your telephone wires or your cable lines, and that's called, again, a modem. That modem usually gets plugged into a cable jack in your wall or into a telephone jack. And now typically, especially if you only have one computer in your home that you want to connect to the internet, you would simply plug your desktop or laptop directly into that modem via what's called an Ethernet cable or a network cable, and that would usually come with the cable modem or DSL modem that your ISP, Internet Service Provider, provides you with. Of course, these days you can also connect to the internet wirelessly, but you usually have to do that through a wireless device. So even if your goal is not to share your internet connection among multiple computers, but rather to access your own internet connection at home wirelessly, one of these home routers can fit the bill as well. So besides this cable modem that your ISP would typically provide you with, electronically they provide you with exactly one IP address or Internet Protocol address. This is a number of the form X.Y.Z.W, where each of those letters actually stands for a number pretty much between 0 and 255 with some restrictions. Every computer on the internet has one of these IP addresses because they are the sort of electronic equivalent of the U.S. postal addresses via which your and my home, for instance, are uniquely addressed throughout the world. So, it turns out that though every computer on the internet, in spirit, has an IP address, you can share one such address among multiple computers, and that's what these so-called home routers allow you to do. If you want to share your connection, then, among multiple computers, or access your internet connection wirelessly, you simply interpose this so-called home router between your cable or DSL modem and the one or more computers in your home. And usually that process is as simple as plugging your home router into your DSL modem or your cable modem, and then plugging your laptop or desktop into the home router so that it sits between the two. Or if you have a wireless laptop or wireless desktop, you don't even need to connect your desktop or laptop to this this home router. And frankly, these days, these devices are shipped in such a way that you can probably just throw the switch and everything will just start working. And you can plug in one, sometimes four computers into your home router, and all of a sudden you'll be sharing your internet connection among multiple computers. Of course, you'll also be sharing your bandwidth, which means if one user in your home is downloading particularly big files or watching large videos via the internet, the others in your home might feel the impact via a slower connection. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think you'll typically experience such, but there actually exist in some more advanced home routers ways of restricting the amount of bandwidth that someone can use at a given time of day or throughout the day. I know this is perhaps of particular interest to those of you with roommates who perhaps like to use the internet all too much. But with that said, the downside of having these computers be so literally plug and play is that they are usually installed without any regard for computer security. So what you typically want to do after plugging one of these home routers in and getting it up and running is immediately connect to its administrative interface and configure it, providing it with a customized username and password, and probably setting up some kind of security settings. Unfortunately, all too many people these days leave the default passwords of these devices alone, which effectively means if you have some malicious or nosy neighbors, they could theoretically connect to your own home network using these default usernames and passwords and potentially wreak havoc or do things that you probably don't want them using, not the least of which might be using the cable modem or DSL modem connection that you're paying $20 or $50 for per month without even your knowledge. So typically you can connect to the administrative interface of these routers simply by pulling up a web browser like Firefox or Internet Explorer, Safari, whatever you happen to use, and usually you can simply visit the following URL, http://192.168.1.1. Sometimes you actually have to visit that same number but ending in .0.1 or sometimes .2.1. It really depends, but trying any of those, particularly in that order, and you're likely to find the administrative interface. Though, of course, you can look in your user's manual for the exact address that you should type for your model. You'll usually then be prompted for a username and or password. Again, look to your user's manual for the default settings on that. And then typically you'll see a web page that really is the administrative interface to your router with which you can configure it. And I'll defer to your user's manual for the particular settings, but generally speaking, among the settings in this wireless router's administrative interface will be a security setting page of some sort. And it's on this security setting page that you can, for instance, specify the so-called Ethernet or MAC addresses of the computers that you only want to be able to access your home router. So for instance, if you want to ensure that only your desktop and your laptop can use this internet connection, you could specify in here what are called their Ethernet addresses. And it depends on your computing platform, but it's not hard to find that address. You type it in, it's a sequence of 12 hexadecimal characters, and that thereafter, your router will only let your computer or your laptop, for instance, route traffic through this particular device. Alternatively, if you're connecting to this device wirelessly, you can usually set up a form of wireless encryption. You can usually do this via a protocol called WEP, W-E-P, or WPA, the latter of which these days, if your computer support it, are probably the more secure. What this typically amounts to is enabling either of those protocols and then specifying a passphrase or an encryption code that you would manually type in or let your router automatically generate one for you. And then the key thing is when you then try to connect subsequently to your wireless router with, say, your wireless laptop, Windows or Mac OS, before actually letting you connect to this router, is going to prompt you this time for a special encryption code. And this is usually something like 26 characters long or somewhat shorter. It depends on how your router is configured and what you typed in. But only once you input that security code will your laptop subsequently connect to that router. Anyone that doesn't know that code should not be able to connect to your wireless router. This is not a significant form of encryption, I would say. I would not be working on national secrets via your wireless home network, but for most users, it's probably more than sufficient. And what it does impede, if nothing else, is unauthorized users or unauthorized neighbors from using your internet connection. A few random tidbits to bear in mind, because again, a lot of these settings will be will be hardware specific, but I can say if you're in the market for one of these devices, I've been a particular fan over the past few years of Linksys devices. They're now owned by Cisco Systems. They're great little devices. I've been pleased with Belkin's hardware as well. It may only be my and my friend's experience, but I had bad experiences with Netgear routers, so personally I have a bit of an aversion to those, but these days I would go for something like Belkin or Linksys. And again, you can find incredible deals via CompUSA or Best Buy when they have their weekend sales, or certainly on Amazon and other online websites. For those of you who are a bit more technically curious and perhaps a bit more adventuresome, the Linksys router in particular, for instance, it's a WRT54G model, that makes it sound scarier than it is, actually has what's called open source firmware in it, which a number of enterprising folks on the internet have modified to their own tastes so as to augment the capability of that particular router. For instance, if you download some third-party firmware or software that runs on this home router, you can not only have all the features that Linksys wanted you to have, but also a number of other features. One of my favorites, for instance, is one that allows you to have what's called a virtual private network, a VPN server, running on your home router. The implication of which, and again, this is for the true technophiles, is so that if you're at your office or generally somewhere on the road, but still connected to the internet, you could access your home network securely by VPNing into your home network, which would be an encrypted connection, and then you could access, for instance, your local printers or fax machines if you so chose, but perhaps more compellingly, any local file server or shared folders that you might have on your home network. Or if you're a true geek and have a TiVo on your home network, you might be able to access that as well as other network devices that you might have. My favorite form of third-party firmware for the Linksys series of devices is made by a group called Svesoft, www.sveasoft.com, and you typically can download their firmware for free or the latest and greatest firmware for a subscription of $20 per month. And for those true technophiles out there, it's a great little add-on to what's already a pretty good device. Couple of other topics to be aware of is, again, the same issue of firmware. If you're ever having problems with your home router or you're having flaky connections and you don't think it's a problem with your cable modem or DSL modem, but rather something with your own configuration, one of the first stops on your path to fixing this yourself should be to the manufacturer's website of your home router, click on support or downloads or drivers or whatever the link happens to be called, and find the latest quote-unquote firmware for your router, which again is just the software that runs on this hardware when you first start it up. Usually these things do have their own mistakes and bugs in them. They were written by humans, and so the latest firmware often can redress problems that you might otherwise stumble upon, particularly if you're having intermittent connection issues or the similar. One other issue to bear in mind is that sometimes insertion of these home routers to your home configuration can wreak a little bit of havoc with things like AOL Instant Messenger or other chat or file sharing programs that, when you previously were directly connected to your cable or DSL modem, worked flawlessly. And that's because if you're trying to direct connect, for instance, as AOL Instant Messenger calls it, to someone else that's also behind a home router, it's a bit of a technical challenge to achieve that, because what these home routers do, in addition to sharing connections, is they also, again, act as what are called firewalls, which essentially prohibit unexpected incoming traffic from entering your home network from the rest of the world. And unintended or undesirable network traffic often includes what are called port scanning attacks or worm attacks or just generally malicious behavior on the internet that is randomly often targeting your own home network. So these home routers tend to keep such traffic out, but unfortunately, they sometimes keep out the good traffic as well. So in short, home routers, terribly easy to set up these days, literally as simple as plugging them into the wall for the most part, but a savvy user wants to bear in mind some of the security implications like we discussed and actually take the next step and configure that home router so that only they know, for instance, the password for it as well as any encryption key that they might set up. If you have any questions or would like some further direction on where to go or what you might want to get, do feel free to drop me a note directly. My email address is Malan, M-A-L-A-N, at post, P-O-S-T, .harvard.edu. Again, my name is David Malan. I'm the instructor for Computer Science E1 at Harvard University's Extension School. And thanks so much to Victor for having me on this afternoon. Take care.
Thank you so much, Professor Malan. And David Malan will be back with us next week, going to be doing a piece on security that you will not want to miss.
All right, here's the problem as I see it. I feel that the router packet on the open relay for the smart host has experienced a frame relay, causing the sniffer to broadcast a VPN protocol.
Even if you don't know what you're talking about.
I think the solution is to tunnel into the VLAN and authenticate the asymmetric encryption of the Linux client server database.
At least you can sound like you do.
That would clarify the drive image syslog to the point where the broadband switch will go binary, causing the power distribution unit to charge up the dilithium crystals, thereby causing a warp field on the BSD ARP OS 10.
Oh, brilliant! We'll put your ideas into effect immediately!
Learn all you need to survive with In the Trenches with Kevin Devon and George Starcher. They've been podcasting since October of 2004, so they're experts.
at sounding like they know what they're talking about.
So what about the proxy server?
Yeah, tell them I'll have a proxy with my coffee.
In the Trenches at KevinDevon.com, the podcast for system administrators and IT professionals. Or those that want to sound like them.
Well, you guys, I wanted to take on a subject tonight that is, some of you are going to say, oh, Victor, you're behind the times. And some of you may say, okay, I get it. Maybe it's good to talk about this a few weeks after it's happened, almost a month. And that is the whole rootkit.txt issue. So for those of you who aren't Unix savvy, and I'm not a big Unix head, I know about Unix because I deal with it a little bit about work and so on. Root is kind of like the owner of the operating system, if you will. It owns all the files. It can read and write to anything. In other words, root is your system god. I mean, there's no other way to put it. If you are the only person who uses your machine, you are probably root in the Unix world and really in the Mac world too. Now, being a switcher and having the typical Mac user podcast, I have become accustomed to root as well. Although it is not used a lot there, you can be root or you can be God. It's pretty easy to understand why a hacker or someone who wants to get into your computer and do something maliciously would want to be root. Why would they want to be God? Well, because they can write and read and kind of have control and power over your entire system. This is why, over the years, hackers have really wanted to develop a lot of different programs that would want to give them access to thousands of ways of getting to your computer and becoming, in essence, root, being the ones that can do things on your computer. The beauty of this is that once a program becomes root, they really kind of load up an entire toolbox worth of keys and files and things that make them be able to have access to all kinds of parts of your computer that may be important to them at will. And this is very important. This is the kind of stuff that lets them know what you're doing when you're using your PC. So recently, we all know, I mean, geez, you have to be under a rock right now to not know that Sony bundled up a little bit of software that basically took your CDs and put a rootkit within the bundle that was your CD. When you loaded your CD or your brand new CD of music that you enjoyed and you loaded it up to your computer, basically the Digital Restriction Management or the DRM basically said, hey, we're going to load this piece of audio into your computer. I want to make sure that you're okay with that and that you know that along with that is going to come a player. And if you read the fine print, they, in essence, told you that they were also including additional software that was going to enable them to know things about your usage of that particular piece of audio. But what they were really doing was they were running a rootkit, a program that would run on a Windows machine without being seen by the average user. And this is where Sony went, in my opinion, way awry. The software didn't exploit a buffer overflow, for example, or something like that, but instead it relied on the user not executing a bit of code in order to activate the exploit. So what it did was it relied that you as a user would say, okay, I have no problem with this DRM. Go ahead and install this audio playing software into my computer. And it relied on our innocence of saying, hey, this is Sony. I trust Sony. So if they are loading a piece of software into my computer because I bought a Sony artist, then I have no problem with whatever they're doing. I am going to avoid and not read the fine print of whatever they are sending me. Well, this technique was really powerful for them because it enabled them to basically install that rootkit and put in all those PIF files that you basically otherwise would avoid and say, oh my God, there's something going on there. Basically, it said, go ahead, take my computer over, Sony. You have the right to do that. And I'm going to give you the right by saying yes to this agreement. So once the Sony rootkit was in your computer, they had free access to all of it. And once that rootkit was made public about a month ago, then there was a mighty, everybody went nuts, if you will, because they said, oh, geez, how can they do this? Of course, a big corporation like Linux should not be doing something like installing a rootkit into my computer, and we're all very upset, and you've taken advantage of me, and all of the different things that you saw in the last month around Sony being bad and evil. Well, we have to take some accountability for what we do in our own computer. The concept of packages being put aside or inside other packages is not new. We as users have to be aware of what we are doing. Sony took advantage, no doubt, of what we were doing in purchasing their music, in attaching another package into their DRM software in order to get a rootkit in our computer. But we need to take the lead. We need to be the ones that are aware of what's going inside of our PCs, because we are the owners of our PCs. Sony doesn't own our PCs. No other company does. But if we simply ignore those DRM messages, those licensing messages that say, oh, go ahead, just put next, no big deal, get through it, I want to play the music, I want to play the movie, then we are going to be the recipients of this kind of software. If in the process of installing a licensing agreement, one of these companies is burying other code, even though they shouldn't, we need to be very careful that we are reading the agreement that we're getting into. In a lot of cases, there's a lot of useful information that if we take a minute to read those things, we're going to be the better off for it. Is it right that they're doing this? Probably not. Are they taking advantage of our naivete, our trust? Yes, they are. But we are the buyer, and buyer beware. We need to be the ones that have the obligation to make sure that when software is being put into our computer, whether it be from Sony or whether it be from Joe Schmo on the street who wrote a cool piece of software, that we are responsible to make sure that unwanted, buried software is not within that software, and that we are vigilant as we would be with spyware or malware, in making sure that this kind of rootkit that comes along with DRM doesn't get into our computers. Don't let them do it. Buyer beware. If you don't like what you're seeing, don't buy the product.
And now, with movie reviews and views on the news, here's Siloquy.
My news story and my movie review are the same this time because it's about that controversial film Brokeback Mountain, which I have not seen yet because the local multiplex doesn't have the guts to throw it onto a screen amidst all the car chase, shoot 'em up, special effects, huge explosions movies on all the other screens. I must admit an initial reluctance to see Brokeback Mountain, however, not because the two cowboys are gay. I don't care what two consenting adults do in private with each other, various volunteers, assorted devices, major farm implements, and fresh vegetables. It's none of my business, but because it's a romance picture and doesn't contain all the elements I usually go to a movie to see, such as car chases, shoot 'em up, special effects, and huge explosions, and sometimes to get myself out of the doghouse. I'll occasionally gain some brownie points by taking my wife to a romantic picture, and while the movie is playing and she is crying, I sit in my seat, eat my popcorn, and have elaborate fantasies about not being in a theater full of weeping women. But I don't know if this is the kind of movie women will weep at. Is it a chick flick? I don't know. I'm confused. Be that as it may, it's up for all sorts of awards and is making a decent amount of money. However, if the producers of this tale, you should pardon the expression, of two cowboys came to me first, I could have told them one word that would have quadrupled the profits of the movie. That one word is cowgirls. I'm Siloquy, that's my 2 cents worth, and someone owes me change.
Well, folks, that's it. We're out of time. I want to thank you guys for being part of the Typical PC User Podcast and for subscribing. If you like what you hear, please go to Podcast Alley and vote for me. Also, go to the Frapper map and add your pin. I have about 120 people, and I would love to double that before the end of the month. So for now, this is Victor Cajal of the Typical PC User Podcast saying, enjoy.